Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What made Joe DiMaggio such a remarkable force in baseball? And why did his life off the field never come close to matching the grace with which he played? The center fielder known to fans as Jolton Joe or the Yankee Clipper lived nearly half a century past his 1951 retirement. Unlike some other former athletes, DiMaggio remained financially comfortable and in good health. But leaving the game took DiMaggio away from the one place he could feel comfortable in his own skin. His much-talked-about marriage to Hollywood goddess Marilyn Monroe ended in less than a year, but he remained more devoted to her than anything or anyone else in his life besides baseball. Jerome Charon is a novelist and cultural critic. He tells DiMaggio's story in his new book, Joe DiMaggio, The Long Vigil. Jerome, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much, Chris.
You write that Babe Ruth was loved, Ty Cobb was reviled, and Joe DiMaggio was revered with an almost religious awe. Can you talk about that?
Well, the Babe was a kind of clown. He loved to frolic on the field. I mean, baseball to him was a kind of serious circus. He was having a good time. And Mantle was pretty much the same way. But for DiMaggio, he only wanted to give of himself on the field. And so his relationship with his audience would almost be like a relationship between a patron and an artist. You could look at his art, but you weren't allowed to touch him.
You actually grew up in the Bronx and saw DiMaggio play many times at the old Yankee Stadium. Can you talk about what he was like to watch on the field?
Well, it was extraordinary because it would be very, very noisy until DiMaggio. He always came out to the batting practice first and got out to the field last. So he was the first person you saw, and there would be complete silence the moment he appeared on the field. I mean, everyone just was watching him, even the opposing bench. I mean, he had the attention of everyone, and it was very striking because I never saw that with any other player. And when he went out in center field, as I say, he was the last one to take his gloves, so you saw that march out onto, you know, that very, very long center field, and it was almost like a religious spectacle.
And did he make it look easy?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. He wasn't trying to make it look easy, but he had such perfect grace and form, and there never was an additional gesture. He never showboated, but somehow he got there like a kind of gazelle. So in retrospect, it seemed easy, but it wasn't easy at all. It was the perfection of his art.
So he was born into this very large immigrant Italian family.
Right.
How did he end up on the baseball diamond instead of fishing like his brothers?
Well, his older brother, Vince, preceded him, went to the San Francisco Seals first. And it's because of Vince that Joe got a chance. Now, he never really played that much sandlot baseball. He just had such a natural affinity for the game, such a natural grace, that he was almost perfect from the moment he began. And that's what's so curious about DiMaggio. He was never really a rookie.
Hmm.
He came up to bat from the first time he appeared. I mean, he was almost a veteran.
And that's got to be a lot of pressure, even in one who early in his career performed so brilliantly, that expectation that he would be perfect all the time.
Yes, that's what ate him up alive. I mean, he did have ulcers. He was very, very nervous. And also when Casey Stengel wanted him to play first base at the end of his career, which would have been better for DiMaggio, he became so nervous that he tripped over his feet. He didn't want to appear foolish. He wasn't a first baseman. He didn't have a first baseman's grace. And he didn't want to play first base. So he only played one game, and then he went back out to center field.
Hmm. You would think that any father would be so excited to have his son be a star in this game that America loved so much, but his dad was never really that impressed by him.
No, his father wasn't very much interested. He wished that Joe would become a fisherman. I mean, there was a tremendous distance between father and son at that point because Joe was a kind of maverick. He went his own way, and Vince and Dom, who were his brothers and were major league ball players, were much closer to the family. I mean, he was, you know, he was a loner. It was very hard for him to be around other people.
What view did he have of his own talent?
Well, again, that's a very difficult question. One, I mean, he understood his value as a ball player, and as he said, I burned to be the very best. He wanted to be the very best there was. And so did Ted Williams, and that was the great rivalry of that era between Williams and DiMaggio. Williams was a greater hitter, but he never had the same perfection that DiMaggio had.
How did DiMaggio get along with his teammates?
Well, he was really adored by his teammates. They looked up to him. They held him in great awe. They saw him, as their natural leader. But he was never that friendly with the other players.
Mm-hmm. He would, I guess this was rather rare for him, but if he were to go out to eat with his teammates, in those instances alone, he would pick up the check.
Yes, that was one of the rare moments when he would pick up a check. I mean, almost never did, but he would always sort of pay for his other teammates. But most of the time he ate inside his room. He didn't want to be followed around by people. He didn't want to sign autographs. He was very misanthropic in a way.
What's so interesting about that sort of rejection of his fans was that at the same time he sort of needed their worship for validation, but then he didn't really allow himself to bask in it when he had it.
Well, that was the contradiction in DiMaggio. I think like other ball players, and particularly like Mantle, who was also very shy, he needed their adulation. He fed off it, but he wouldn't admit it to himself. That was the problem. He went around feeling and thinking that he didn't need very much, but I think he lived to hear that shout of the fans.
He did have a long friendship with this bar owner, this guy named Toots
Shore.
Yeah. Can you talk about what drew them together?
Well, Toots was a great, was a baseball addict, and he opened the nightclub in the early 40s called Toots Shores, and it was mostly for sports addicts. And Joe became the centerpiece of Toots Shores. He occupied table one, which was the most prominent table. And you might find Sinatra there. You might find Jackie Gleason or some other ball players. But it was a place where DiMaggio could be seen, but he would also be protected by Toots Shore, who wouldn't let anyone near him.
And he would call Toots from the road almost every day.
Yes, there was a tremendous friendship between them, and Toots was a real character. I mean, he loved to have, his fan club or the people that he adored around him, and there was this tremendous intimacy between Toots and Joe. I think that Joe was his favorite ball player.
So let's talk about DiMaggio's first marriage to a showgirl named Dorothy Arnold. How do they fall in love?
Well, he met her, in the late 30s. They married at that point. She was a showgirl. He would say later on in his life that everyone remembered, Marilyn Monroe, but people didn't remember how beautiful his first wife was. Unlike Marilyn, she was willing to give up her career, to have children and to stay at home. But he was so morose, he was so moody, that very often he wouldn't speak to her for 2 or 3 weeks. So there was no way that marriage could ever work.
Is it going too far to characterize him as abusive to her?
Oh, I think he was. I don't think it's going too far at all. I think he was abusive, and he was also abusive with Marilyn, but as I try to say in the book, I mean, it comes out of a very complex core of identities that he had. I mean, he was so insecure away from the field that, for example, if Dorothy wore a dress with a low neckline, he wouldn't let her out of the house. He didn't want other men to look at his wife. I mean, so he had an incredible jealousy and, in a way, wanted to keep her in a birdcage. And she didn't want to live in that birdcage, and eventually she left him.
He had just one son, and this is an incredibly heartbreaking detail. He
Very
never
sad
was
story, yeah. know?
Yeah, he was never really able to relate to him.
I don't think, you know, yes, you have to remember that when Joe Jr. was born, he was the most famous baby in the world. I mean, he was on the front page of almost every newspaper, so there was this tremendous adulation of the boy, of the family, you know. But on the other hand, it was very difficult for him to be both a father and a son. I mean, familial connections didn't work with him. He wasn't very friendly with his brother Dom either, you know. And Dom, who was also a center fielder, never really tried to compete with Joe. The problem really came from Joe, not from Dom.
So he signed on with the Yankees, which was the only team he played with in the major leagues,
yes.
In 1936. He's
right.
At the height of his career, and World War II breaks out.
Yes, and he doesn't really want to go into the Army. And we have to understand that for most of the players, they really weren't. The only one of the few really active players was Ted Williams. He became a pilot, and therefore the war enlarged him in some way. But all Joe DiMaggio did was play baseball games in the service and then play pinochle with generals after he played these games. So we have to understand that for him it was a complete waste of time.
Did he join the Army because he felt like it would hurt his image to not do so?
There was tremendous pressure on him. He was being booed by the end of 42. So, I mean, there was nothing else he could do. I mean, Bob Feller, who was probably the most famous pitcher of his era, you know, joined up much earlier, so that there was no room. You know, that was the price that the hero had to pay. And he didn't really want to pay it, but he had to pay it.
So by the time he got out of the service, Dorothy, his first wife, had filed for divorce.
Right.
Was that a blow to him?
I think it was a blow to his ego, but, I mean, it's very difficult to say what it really meant. I think he got over her quite quickly, but it was, you know, it was a terrible blow to him.
And certainly he seems to have had a type, at least physically. He liked blonde, beautiful women.
Yes, he liked showgirls, mm-hmm. You know, and Alex Rodriguez is no different today. You know, it's, you know, the idea of you know, a girl from the Copacabana or someone who was an actress was very appealing to him. I mean, these were trophy wives. And so, I mean, what real chance did he have to meet someone who could be a genuine companion? And did he really want a genuine companion? So there's a contradiction. He wanted men to look at his trophy wife, but not look too long.
Yeah, which is a tough thing to do. And it's also, as you mentioned, tough to find someone who can sort of relate to him on his level, but also is willing to do the things that he expected of a wife.
Yes, and I think it was very difficult for all the women involved in his life. I mean, what was their real role? I mean, this was true of Marilyn, and this was true of Dorothy, and of course, he never married again after Marilyn, you know, after things finished up with Marilyn.
Jerome Charon is my guest. He's a novelist and cultural critic. His new book is called Joe DiMaggio, The Long Vigil. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and cultural critic Jerome Charon. His new book is called Joe DiMaggio, The Long Vigil. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Before we get to his life after baseball, Jerome, I want to talk a little bit about this amazing 1941 hitting streak that to this day the record is unbroken.
Yes, I mean, but you also have to remember that he also had a hitting streak when he was in the minor leagues. So he had an incredible consistency, and unlike most sluggers, he seldom struck out. So he was constantly guarding the ball, you know, as it went over the plate. But the kind of fierce concentration and competition that this would take, I mean, it would be very, very hard to equal that streak, though it's not mathematically impossible. It would have to be a kind of hitter like Joe DiMaggio, I mean, who really didn't strike out, because once you strike out a lot of times, like Alex Rodriguez, it's not possible to have that kind of a streak.
Of course, as we move into the late 40s, his body starts to break down a bit. He had a lot of problem with his heel, is that right?
Heel, yeah, he had a damaged heel, and he also had a problem with his throwing arm. So he was really almost like a mummy when he played in his last seasons. There are sometimes after a game when he couldn't even raise his arm to comb his hair. I mean, that's how difficult it was. But, of course, he never showed this pain while he was out on the field. And it's almost because of this that he had a lifelong feud with Mickey Mantle, because Casey Stengel in 51, in the 51 World Series, said to Mantle, you know, go into center field and take balls away from Joe because he can't run. He'll never get there. And, of course, what happened is that they nearly collided, I believe, in the second game of the 51 series. Mantle tripped over an object on the field and really tore his leg. So from that point on, he despised DiMaggio. But it wasn't DiMaggio's fault. And it was Casey Stengel's fault.
And he and Casey Stengel never had a good relationship.
No, Casey felt that, you know, once DiMaggio was there, Casey would never be able to control the team. So he wanted to get rid of him. So he knew that he needed DiMaggio for a little while, but wanted to get rid of him as soon as possible. And when Mantle came up, he said, I have my man Mantle who can hit home runs over buildings, you know. So he really nursed Mantle along in a very significant way.
So after the 1951 season, Joe DiMaggio is still only, what, in his mid-30s, and he retires from the one place in his life where he feels fully himself.
Right. I don't think he could have played much longer. He could no longer pull the ball. He was very wounded as an athlete. He might have played one season more if Mantle hadn't spooked him. He was very spooked by Mantle and all the adulation that Mantle was getting. But there was really very little. He didn't understand the consequences of having no education and of also the fact that the Yankee organization really didn't have much room for him, as it didn't have much room for Babe Ruth. Hmm. It never allowed the Babe to manage, and the Babe wanted very much to be a manager of the Yankees.
So the Yankees give DiMaggio what is probably the worst job in the world for someone that, in your words, you describe as almost autistic in terms of his lack of ability to communicate with other human beings. They make him a broadcaster.
He becomes a broadcaster. He has an interview show both before and after the game, and he can't even read his own name on a cue card. He needs a cue card to say, hello, I'm Joe DiMaggio, this is the Joe DiMaggio show. So he's very, very nervous. And very uncomfortable in front of a camera.
But he remained a huge star, still a household word everywhere in America.
Well, I think those who saw DiMaggio, and I was lucky enough to see him, never forgot him. And also this was true of Henry Kissinger, for example, who when he was an immigrant boy in the late 30s living in Washington Heights and saw the Yankee game for the first time, he was struck with wonder over this man who had a kind of perfect grace. And in the book, I like to consider him as much of an artist as he is an athlete. And that, to me, makes him so much apart from every other ball player.
So the legend goes that he and Marilyn Monroe were set up on a blind date, but she certainly sort of knew what she was getting into.
Absolutely. It wasn't a very blind date for her. She was very much in a hole because she had posed for some nudie calendars a few years before these calendars surfaced, and that would have broken any movie star other than Marilyn. But that wasn't the only problem. She claimed to be an orphan, and suddenly it was discovered that she not only had a mother, but a mother who was living in an insane asylum. So without Joe DiMaggio to rescue her, her career would have ended right there. And once they began dating, they became the prince and princess of America, and that really saved her career. And he saved her career twice, because when her own studio, Fox, suspended her because she didn't want to act in a very stupid film, once she announced that she had married DiMaggio, that suspension was lifted in like 3 seconds. They couldn't afford to be on bad terms with Mrs. Joe DiMaggio.
Did she love him?
I think she did in her own fashion. I think that she used him in some way, but on the other hand, I think she did love him as much as she could. She was a very wounded creature. It was very, very hard for her to function outside of her role as a movie star. But she was very, very, ambitious, not only to be a star, but to be a great actress. And DiMaggio never understood this. He thought he would marry her. She would have a lot of kids. She would be happy being a housewife. He didn't understand her at all. And she was much more complex than he was. She wanted to go to museums. She wanted to see things. He wanted to sit home in front of a screen and have a TV dinner. So how long could that marriage have really lasted, even under the best of circumstances?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that he ended up in this really passionate relationship with a woman that was always known for her extreme, the level of her sexuality, and then he wanted her to be wearing, turtlenecks and long skirts.
Well, I mean, they did have a great deal of heat between them, in terms of their sexual relations, but of course, that was enough. Where was the world outside, the sexuality? It didn't exist. He just didn't have the credentials. He didn't have the interest. I don't think he ever went to a museum in his life. And all he was interested in was old Western movies, he didn't have her curiosity, and he didn't quite understand that.
And she would complain that all he ever wanted to do was talk about baseball, which she didn't care for at all. She had never seen him play.
Well, it wasn't only that. It wasn't only that he talked about baseball. It's that he just kept her in a golden cage. And she wasn't a woman who liked to be in a cage. She loved to be out there. Now, when he took her to Yankee Stadium, that was amazing for the other players and for the fans, and she kind of loved that. But that wasn't enough for her.
Mm-hmm. There's this really telling story in the book where they go together, I guess, to entertain some troops overseas?
Well, yes, they go to Japan, and that's going to be their honeymoon because Joe is going to play some exhibition games in Japan. He'd already been there before, and he was welcomed as a great hero. But he went with Marilyn. What he didn't understand is that by this time, she was a much bigger star than he was, and everyone came out to see her and not to see him.
And that was devastating for him.
Yeah, that was profoundly disturbing.
What do you make of the fact that just a couple of months into their marriage, it only lasted 9 months, but she was already telling people, I'm planning to marry Arthur Miller.
Oh, she said that, very, very early into a marriage because the honeymoon was an absolute disaster, and that's one of the times when he did beat her up. And so from that point on, she really didn't want to be with him and was trying to look for some kind of exit strategy.
So the world had embraced and become obsessed with this glamorous couple. How did the media and fans respond when they announced they were splitting up?
Oh, I think it was devastating. They were America's royalty, So people were more and more in love with Marilyn and loved Joe because. because of Marilyn, so that when they split up, I mean, there was a great deal of anxiety. And when she married Arthur Miller, it was never quite the same intensity, you know. They called it, you know, the pussycat and the owl. But, you know, in some way, it never had the same heat.
I thought it was interesting that even after she and DiMaggio split up, she maintained a reasonably close relationship with Joe Jr., his son.
Yes, she not only retained a close relationship with Joe Jr., but she would also, you know, go to previews with Joe. He became a kind of escort for her. And it's thanks to Joe Jr. that they maintained a kind of relationship. But she would say, you know, with anyone I loved, I always ended up loving them, you know, retaining a little love for them. So I think that once he became part of her life, she did have a deep affection for him. And when she had a safe at home, its combination was 555. And 5, of course, was the number of his uniform.
Hmm. And she kept a picture of him in her closet.
Yeah. She had a kind of nostalgia, a kind of fondness for him, but they were going in different directions, and there's no way. And I think she was really enraged because when she began, she came to New York to do some location shots for The 7-Year Itch. There's that famous moment when you see her standing over the grate and her dress blows up and you see her underwear. Now, DiMaggio saw this. He was spying on her and he went ballistic. And she was only being playful. There was a kind of playful, you know, joy in that action, and it became one of the most famous photographs of the 20th century. Now, when he met her, you know, after that, and they were back at that hotel, he did beat her up. I mean, so from that point on, I mean, the marriage was ended.
Did they both project onto each other something that never was there?
I think that was probably true, but when you consider that, that would be true of any two stars, you know. I mean, they live within their glamour, and it's very hard to see the person under that glamour. And I think that, you know, he was not willing to go in the direction that she wanted to go, which was towards more culture, towards playing much better roles, to being in charge of her own career. I mean, he did help her to some degree, but he just wasn't able to deal with the complexity that she had, both as a woman and as a human being.
But it never was a fully clean break between the two of them. And several years later, she was hospitalized in a mental facility, and he was the one who got her out.
Yes, not only that, he said, I want my wife back, you know, and she wasn't his wife anymore. And also, very few people know that they were scared, you know, they were supposed to be married again. And he buried her on the very day that their second marriage was supposed to take place. So it's a very sad ending, of course, for her and also for him.
You don't have the sense that their second marriage would have worked out any better than the first one,
though. No, honestly, I don't believe it would have worked out. But, I mean, she, you know, she was a little bit older. She might have been more understanding of him. And I think they might have drawn a little bit closer. But let's say at this point it might have had a chance. The first time around it didn't.
Why do you think he never got over her?
I think he deeply loved her. I think she was someone who really didn't use his fame. She wasn't interested in his fame. She wasn't interested in his money. You know, she said, I don't want to be rich. I want to be wonderful. And I think that moved him. I mean, she touched him in some very deep way because she was childlike. She had a kind of purity, and so did he. He had a kind of purity as an athlete. And she had her own purity as an actress, and I think he was drawn to that sort of, you know, deer-like, you know, skittish creature that she was, and she moved him deeply.
And unlike many of her other lovers, he never used her either.
No, he never used her in any way. He did beat her up, and that's unfortunate, but he didn't try to use her fame, you know, as Arthur Miller did. whereas any other than Yves Montand was the same way, you know, making love to her and then calling his wife on the phone. So it was very sad for her. I mean, and she was the most famous actress of her time. I mean, her fame was worldwide, and it keeps growing every year. And of course, one of the reasons we still remember Jo is because of Marilyn, and we can't forget that.
Did fans know at the time about the violence between the two of them?
No, that was not known. No, that was not known. We knew very little about celebrities in that time.
Do you think that would have destroyed his public image had that come out?
It would have hurt it. Whether it would have destroyed it, I don't know, but it certainly would have hurt him. But I don't think any sports writer would have ever written that. Of course, they would write that now. It's a very different world.
Mm-hmm. Jerome, what was Joe DiMaggio's relationship to money?
Well, he was a skinflint. He didn't like to spend it. He became very rich, later on because he began doing all these signings for the memorabilia shows. But he didn't like to spend money. And as he grew older, he became quite crazy. I mean, like, for example, he would be invited to a golfing exhibition and he would get golf clubs and he would say, okay, that's fine. But when you went to his living room, it was packed up with baseball gloves, with golf clubs, with things that he never needed and things he never touched. So he became a hoarder, a collector, which is very, very sad. He didn't need any of this. He was Joe DiMaggio.
My guest is novelist and cultural critic Jerome Charon. His new book is called Joe DiMaggio, The Long Vigil. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and cultural critic Jerome Charon. His new book is called Joe DiMaggio, The Long Vigil. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Jerome, obviously people listening recognize at this point that DiMaggio was not a jocular person. There's not a lot of humor in the book. But I have to say, it made me smile when I heard about DiMaggio ultimately meeting Paul Simon and taking him to task for
right.
The lyrics of Mrs. Robinson.
Right. And also, he wanted to sue Paul Simon for using his name. And he said, what do you mean I haven't been around? You know, I'm doing commercials for Mr. Coffee. And he just didn't understand, I mean, how diminished he'd become. He couldn't tell the difference between being Mr. Coffee and being Joe DiMaggio.
Did he need the money from those endorsements? He did that, and he did the Bowery Bank, right?
Look, he would always say that he didn't do anything because he needed the money, but it was for the want of money. In other words, having grown up very poor, he had this sort of, and being an immigrant's son, and Bob Dylan wrote a wonderful song about that status, I Pity the Poor Immigrant, you know, who sort of throws his life away, you know, in the search of money. I think this was the same with Joe. He just needed to collect. He needed to hoard. And he left California to live in Florida because he didn't want to pay the state income tax. And it's extraordinary that he ended up in a town called Hollywood, Florida, when he was escaping Hollywood all his life.
And he didn't like to sign autographs unless he got money for them.
No, he would never sign. Not only that, he would never sign Yankee Clipper. You know, if you wanted him to sign Yankee Clipper, you had to pay extra. So that he was very perverse and very strange about all these signings. But a very sad and telling fact, and most people refuse to believe this, but it's true, is that in one day of signing bats and gloves and other paraphernalia, he earned more than he earned in his entire career as a New York Yankee.
Hmm.
That's an extraordinary statistic, but it's true.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Jadeen in Carrollton. Hi, Jadeen.
Hi. In 1951, I worked at the Warfield Theater in San Francisco, and Joe DiMaggio came in with a woman about as tall as he was, and I was working loges, and they went to the left end of the loges and sat on the aisle, and I went down and asked for his autograph, and he was very kind and gave it to me.
He didn't charge you for it, huh?
No.
No. Well,
I think he was kinder to women, so I think you were lucky. Yeah, at some point he would give autographs. You know, he was perverse. If you caught him, and he loved policemen, so If you were a cop, you might come over to him with a baseball and say, "This is for my son," and he would sign it. He loved policemen and beautiful women.
Let's go back to the phones, 1-800-933-5372. This time we have Terry on the line in Dallas. Hi, Terry.
Hello. I just want to say I'm glad this gentleman is on talking about that, because I lived around the corner from the Yankee Stadium.
Oh, good.
And we used to watch the ball games from the rooftops.
So did I.
I could say that DiMaggio, Henrik, and Keller were the three guys who were the outfielders. Keller, I got his autograph. Henrik, I couldn't get for some reason. But Joe would not sign my ball. And I had a ball there, and I said to him, "Well, you know, at least sign my paper." He says, "No, I don't have time." He walked right by me.
Well, I think your situation is
nasty,
the usual one. It was much more rare when he would sign a ball or a bat or whatever it is. So that cold shoulder you got was the DiMaggio that unfortunately most of us remember. I mean, there was a stinginess, a meanness at a certain point, and it's hard to explain why. He just felt uncomfortable in that situation. He wanted to perform on the field and then disappear.
Can you talk a little bit about the design of the old Yankee Stadium? The new one is beautiful, but for people who spend a lot of time at the old one, they just don't compare.
No, the new Yankee Stadium is more like a museum. You know, there's a Hall of Fame. And it was remarkable for a year or two or three. One stadium, the old and the new one, stood side by side, and you could see into the bowl of the older stadium, whereas you can't see anything now. For example, when I grew up in the Bronx and stood on the Grand Concourse at 161st Street, I could see right into the bowl of Yankee Stadium, and now it's completely shut off. So it's more like a museum than it is. You know, it's a 21st century ballpark, but it doesn't have the grit and the power and the sense of memory that the earlier ballpark did.
Is it easier to get a home run in Yankee Stadium now?
It probably is, I would say. I don't know the actual dimensions, but I would be pretty certain that it is.
So let's talk about this. There was this on-again, off-again relationship with Marilyn Monroe. They had gotten back together. It was Joe DiMaggio who identified her body at the morgue when she died.
Yes, because her lawyer was very reluctant to do anything, and they said they palmed it off on Joe DiMaggio because they felt uncomfortable, and to this day, we don't really know how she died. I mean, it probably was an overdose, a mixture of drugs. It's not the first time it happened, but what was unfortunate is usually when it happened, there was someone else around to call the doctor or shake her, you know, out of her torpor. And at this time, there was no one there, so she literally died all alone in a quote, hacienda that was almost completely barren of furniture. All she had was a bed and a lamp, and it's a very tragic ending to an extraordinary person.
And DiMaggio, for years, carried a grudge against the Kennedys.
Yes, he felt that the Kennedys had ruined her in some way, and what most people don't know is that she was carrying on an affair with both Bobby and Jack at the same time, and some scholars believe that she really was in love with Bobby, not with Jack, and there may have been a possibility, and again, it's hard to prove, that Bobby visited her on the day she died, and it was her unhappiness over this visit that threw her into a kind of tailspin. But, of course, it's difficult to prove any of this. We know that he was in San Francisco at this time, but many people believe that he also visited her.
Hmm. Whatever happened to Joe Jr.?
Oh, that's a very, very sad story. He went to Yale, but he sort of dropped out. He became a Marine. Of course, we have to be a little bit careful. I mean, Joe did support him in many of these ventures. He supported him in business ventures. But Joe Jr. did got married. He adopted two children. But it didn't really work out for him, and he ended up being a kind of hobo, and he died as a hobo. It's very, very sad because this complete disconnect between father and son, but it may be possible that they had both the same sense of total isolation, that they may have been more similar or more alike than we like to think,
Do you think, if a modern, psychiatric professional were to look at him, do you think he was depressed? Is that what you think his problem was throughout his life?
I think he was depressed. I mean, again, I'm giving you an unclinical interpretation because, I'm not a doctor, but I think he did suffer from a kind of depression, and I think he suffered from that very early on. It was very, very difficult for him to maneuver. He was so shy. And he didn't have any language, and he really suffered because he had a lack of education. He just was crippled psychically, and this never left him, and he had no curiosity. For example, he went to Moscow and visited the Kremlin, and all he could think about was that he couldn't get a good pastrami sandwich in Moscow. Now, that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see the Kremlin or to see what Moscow was like, to be in a foreign city, no matter where it was, and to think of pastrami sandwiches, describes someone who has no curiosity whatsoever.
He did have a fairly good relationship with his granddaughters, is that right?
Yes, he did, and of course he left some of his money to them, but this was near the very end of his life, and why wasn't he a better son, a better father to his son. So I think that there is a certain sentimentality attached to that. I'm not taking anything away from that relationship, but why wasn't he a better father? And I distrust the fact that he said he was leaving all of his money to his granddaughters. Well, why couldn't he have taken care of his son?
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't make sense. There's something wrong with that scenario.
And then they turned around and auctioned off most of his possessions for the value of them. Would that have made him crazy?
It probably would have, but what did it matter at this point? He was a kind of walking memorabilia show. For me, he was a corpse. He was a living corpse. He just didn't allow himself any kind of room to maneuver. Why didn't he meet another woman? Even if he was desperately in love with Marilyn, come on, he lived another 38 years.
Mm-hmm.
He could have found someone, to be with. But yes, he was stuck in the phantom of his own past, and he remained there.
I think
having a woman around him might have eased, someone he cared for might have eased some of his pain.
Did you find, Jerome, that looking at his life story for the purposes of writing this book, you came away understanding him more and liking him less than you had before?
No, I didn't like him less. Having read the earlier biography by Richard Ben Kramer, which showed him at his worst, I liked him even then. I thought that Kramer was ungenerous to him. I wasn't happy about the fact of his slapping Marilyn around. That was very disturbing to me. But on the other hand, he was this idiot savant. He just, didn't know how to behave. He didn't know how to function. I mean, he had no one to calm him, no one to soothe him, no one to make him feel better. And that's very, very sad. I ended up feeling a tremendous sadness for him. But I admired him so completely as an artist, athlete, and I never lost that admiration. And this is what I wanted to write about. I wanted to describe as best I could the kind of perfection he had on the field, and a perfection that almost no other ball player ever had or ever will have. And to me, that was much more important than the 56-game streak. It wasn't only that he looked beautiful and was beautiful, but he moved with such an absolute grace that you were overwhelmed whenever you watched.
I have to ask, you've written all these novels, and this, of course, is a nonfiction work.
Right.
But he sounds like a character that would be really fascinating for someone to turn into a fictional character.
Well, I may yet do that. I mean, the difficulty is that he had so little language, so, how to find the voice. I mean, right now I'm writing a novel about Abraham Lincoln, but it's much easier to find Lincoln's voice than it is to find Joe DiMaggio's voice, the voice of a man who had so few words. But I hope that one day I will be able to do it.
Do you think, I thought that the telling of his life story in this book was just really fascinating. Do you think there's something about the qualities that a novelist brings to a story like this that is different from another kind of historian writing the same story?
I think that's a very good question. I think it brings to the book the skills of a narrator, of a narrating voice, so that when you're writing about him, he almost becomes a kind of fictional character. I mean, you're restrained by the facts, and they never step outside of the facts, but you're still forming sentences, around his life. So it gave me a little bit more room particularly when I was writing about him and Marilyn.
Jerome Charon is a novelist and cultural critic. His new book is called Joe DiMaggio, The Long Vigil. Jerome, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you this hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you, Kim. I really appreciate your inviting me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis, an engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.